Well, hello, everybody. This is Dr. Carla Wills Brandon coming to you live from a very chilly, chilly Galveston Island. I am just not used to this weather. The icicles are forming on my palm trees. And our heater went out. Oh, who would have thought on the coldest night in December our heater has gone out? So I'm sitting up here on the second floor of my old 100-year-old house, and I'm wrapped in my grandmother's afghan, and I'm wearing a ratty-looking sweatshirt, and my dog is sitting on my feet, and my children and my husband are in another room, and they're wrapped up in blankets, and we've been told that we will be without heat up here until Tuesday. But we are hardy souls, so we will survive. Actually, to be honest with you, my idea of cold is New Mexico in a whiteout at about 0 degrees. So this is for me shorts weather. But for you in the East, you folks in the East and you folks in the Midwest, you guys are getting pounded. In the East especially, the snow is coming down. So stay warm and stay safe. Galveston Island has been full of activity as usual. The spirits were out and alive and well. Every year on the island, we have something called Dickens on the Strand. And Dickens on the Strand is a huge, huge Victorian-themed festival. And every year, the first weekend in December, a host of costume characters fill the streets of the Strand, which is actually on the bay side of the island. Yes, we have a beach side where we have bona fide waves, not waves like you folks in California, but we do have waves here, and then we have a bay side. And the bay side, on the bay side, that used to be the old district where business was for this island, and it's now actually a National Historical Landmark. And so every year everybody dresses up in their Victorian clothes, and if the weather cooperates, we roast chestnuts, and it becomes absolutely packed, and there's entertainment and food, and all the artisans come out, and the volunteers and the guests alike. People make a big deal about this Victorian clothing thing. I mean, you have women in hoop skirts and fine hats, and men are wearing top hats and spats, and there are carolers and gobs of bagpipes. I just love the bagpipes. I had a really interesting experience years ago. I went to Scotland, and I was in Edinburgh, and all of a sudden there was a lone bagpipe player, when he started playing, and I had a bit of a memory of a past life. It was an awesome experience. So anyway, I'm a big bagpipe fiend. But there are magicians who come out, and we've got some sword swallowers and some hypnotists, and of course there are roasted nuts and warm spice cider, and all of those wonderful scents fill the air. And then the artisans, they hawk their wares to all the folks who are doing their Christmas shopping. And actually, the great-great-grandson of Charles Dickens actually shows up every year. I'm not kidding you. His name is Mark Charles Dickens, and he shows up, and they have all sorts of wonderful gatherings at some of the old Victorian homes, and he comes and he reads from his great-great-grandfather's books, and it's an incredible experience. And as I said, the Strand was once, it was the Wall Street of the Southwest because of its location, believe it or not. Many people who know about Galveston, when they think of Galveston today, they think, ah, redneck Riviera, but believe it or not, Galveston was more popular than New Orleans before the 1900 storm, and there was lots and lots of old money here, and there still is some old money here. Actually, during the Civil War, many of the buildings on the island, they were used to hold and house prisoners. I have a friend who does ghost tours down here, And the reason why he does, and this is a very popular destination, if you're one of those folks who likes to rotate your vacation around spirit activity, Galveston's a great place to come visit. And there are ghost tours, and there are sightings of both Confederate soldiers and Union soldiers. See, the island down here, during the Civil War, it actually changed hands twice. So at one point, the Union, they were running the island, and then the Confederate soldiers were running the island. A lot of the cemeteries around here are very, very interesting. It's interesting to go see who was a Confederate soldier and who was a Union soldier. And so many of the island buildings down here were also not only used to house prisoners, but they were also used to hospitalize the wounded from both sides, depending on who was in charge. And some of these buildings, they still are standing. And as I said, to this day, there continue to be reports of both Union and Confederate soldiers who they're still lingering. They're still hanging around. And so I hate to make fun of folks in the Midwest, but we get a lot of people here from the Midwest, and they visit, and there'll be a family, and they'll be going in and out of the old buildings, which have all been beautifully restored, and somebody will catch a glimpse of a Confederate soldier and come running out of the buildings, wondering if they're losing their mind. And the locals around here will just pat them on the back and say, "Nah, let me give you a little bit of the history," and we'll tell them the history of the Civil War as it happened on the island. And then, of course, we talked a little bit about the great storm of 1900. Now, what I didn't share with you is that after the 1900 storm, which killed 9,000 people on this island, once the cleanup began, after the waters began to recede and the wind and the rain died down, there were bodies everywhere. And what happened was, those who survived the storm, they immediately picked up the bodies. My street, as I have shared, was lined with bodies. And what they did is they loaded the bodies up on barges. There were so many of them, it was overwhelming. And they took the bodies out to sea, to bury them at sea. But sadly, what happened was nature had a last cruel trick to play. It wasn't bad enough that the island got pounded by the storm, but as the tide turned, the bodies began to wash up on the beaches by the thousands. So once again, the Strand became a morgue, just like it was during the Civil War. Temporary morgues were set up in the Strand district, and ultimately what ended up happening is they had to set up huge burning pyres for burning, for cremation. In some cases, sympathetic citizens would bury as many of the dead as possible in their own backyards. Who knows who's buried in my backyard? So to this day, it's not unusual for renovators in areas like my neck of the woods of the city to unearth bones. And these bones are presumed to be the bones of the flood victims. And they're found in shallow graves and sometimes inside plastered walls. It's really, really something. And so, of course, at Dickens, yes, people will also report visitations and apparitions. As a matter of fact, one of the families that visited, they were at the beach, which is not that far from the Strand. And they were very, very alarmed when what appeared to be a weeping woman and a small child began to follow them. They just became very unnerved. And when the family finally stopped and turned to confront these people who were following them, there was no sign of either the woman or her child. So it seems as though every building on the Strand has a ghost or two. So every Dickens, the spirits of Galveston, they intermingle with the families dressed in Victorian costume, walking up and down the Strand. And you know what? It would really, really be nice if all communities were as open as ours. I mean, I do a lot of talking to other people via the internet, workshops, a lot of my workshops. I'm going to London, actually, in January. I'm going to be doing a presentation on, it's a big international conference that has to do with slave labor, and my topic is going to be Hitler's Holocaust and Stalin's gulags, but that's basically the theme of the conference. It's going to be taking a look at the impact of slave labor and the Holocaust on families, and it seems like every time I go do something like that, and that's my other life, I go participate in my other life, this life that I'm sharing with you today, sort of seeps in, and I get some interesting reactions. Either people are very interested in what I say, or they think I'm a kook. And you know what? More and more and more celebrities are now talking about afterlife experiences. In one of my books, I really went and hunted around to see what were the celebs saying about the afterlife. And there are some great books out there that talk about, it's not only everyday people who are having these experiences, but there are a lot of celebrities out there who have had these experiences. And what's interesting is that, as we've said before, discussed before, with more and more of the shows coming out with that paranormal bent, it seems like more and more of these little celebrities are being interviewed with regard to what their beliefs are on the afterlife. Liz Taylor is someone who, she has been very open about a near-death experience that she had. And a lot of people think she's really cracked when she talks about this stuff, but this experience that she had was 43 years ago. So she's been talking about this for 43 years. And she recently recounted it again for a newspaper. She talked about how she felt her spirit leaving her body when she was near death in London. And while she was having her near-death experience, a near-death experience is an experience where someone they are threatened with imminent death. That's basically the definition of a near-death experience. And what happens is that either they are in an accident, lots of people who have surgeries have near-death experiences, something happens to them that brings them to the brink of death, and then they return. And a lot of people, what they describe, the experiences for the near-death experience are incredibly consistent. And Raymond Moody, he has been researching them for a long, long time. My buddy Kenneth Ring researched them for a long time. He is still dabbling a little bit, but not so much anymore. But what they did is those researchers looked at the consistency. My buddy Bruce Grayson continues to investigate them. Jeffrey Long, another friend of mine. But anyway, old Liz Taylor, she shared again about seeing her third husband, film producer Mike Todd, who was killed in an airplane crash in 1958. And she said, it's still hard to talk about. Here's what I'm going to pose for all of you out there who have had these experiences. It's very hard for a lot of us to share these experiences immediately after we have them because they are so life-altering. So it's not unusual to hear from an experiencer, it's really hard to talk about, or I can't find words to describe it, or the emotion is so overwhelming, or the colors I experienced, the sounds I experienced, there are not words in the human language to describe this. But she saw her husband, Mike, and he said, it's not your time. And she said that she fought. She did not want to come back, but she did come back. And she said she remembers all of it, and so she is no longer afraid to die. And this was told to W Magazine. Now, believe it or not, the straightest of the straightest of the straightest, I never, ever in a bazillion years would have believed this one. Dan Rather talks to ghosts. This came out from Newsmax, and it came out not that long ago. and it was a little article about Dan Rather. Now, Dan Rather, when I look at Dan Rather, I see like a Dan Rather's from Texas, and when I would look at him, I would visualize somebody who eats a lot of chicken fried steak and cream gravy and has a real sort of Methodist bent, nothing against Methodists, but not somebody who would dabble into exploring the paranormal at all. And this news clip says Dan Rather talks to ghosts. And it's interesting who he's been talking to, too. Now it can be told. Dan Rather has an impeachable source. And this is for real. The ghost of Edward R. Murrow, the famous newsman. Actually, George Clooney just released a movie about Edward R. Murrow, the chain smoker that he was. But anyway, the ghost of Edward R. Murrow, who lives on the third floor at CBS headquarters and regularly chats with Dan. Ed Murrow's ghost is here, Rather told The Hollywood Reporter. I've seen him and talked to him on the third floor of this building many times late at night. And I can tell you that he's watching over us. I mean, this is just, he's like, it's like he's reporting the news when he shares this. Rather says he chats with the ghost of the legendary CBS newsman, but neglected to report what the two talk about. So, Hollywood starlets and newsmen aren't the only ones interested in sharing otherworldly encounters. There are some folks, some university folks, who are taking a hard look at ADCs and NDEs and DBVs. ADCs, after-death communications, NDEs, near-death experiences, DBVs, deathbed visions. So, from Charlottesville, Virginia, The Daily Progress. The inspiration for NBC's new drama medium is participating in, is this unreal or not? I mean, medium. It's kind of like, I was with a couple last weekend, and the woman had been with her father when he was getting ready to pass. And we had had dinner, and they had had a couple of glasses of wine, and she was feeling pretty relaxed, and we were going to go down to Dickens, and then we decided we didn't want to, and we started talking. And she shared with me that her father had passed, and that she was a big fan of the NBC drama program Medium. And I asked her, well, what's so intriguing about that show for you? And she shared with me that when her father was getting ready to pass, he had had powerful deathbed visions. She said that her father had been a good Catholic, that his faith had carried him through many hard times, and that he'd go to Mass on a regular basis. But what she did say is that when he had his deathbed visions shortly before he passed, he saw only dead people, and this was very concerning to her. Well, that's a classic departing vision. When people are getting ready to pass, it's not uncommon for them to be visited by deceased loved ones, relatives, friends, who come for the purpose of escorting them to the other side. But as usual, here is this woman who is educated. She's a psychologist. Her husband's a psychologist, and they have no awareness that a deathbed vision is a common phenomenon. And so she hadn't talked to anybody about this. And then she tentatively said to me, when he first had the experience, it scared him. It scared him to be seeing people who were deceased. And that's not uncommon either. A lot of people have a perception about what life after death is that might be based on their religious upbringing or what they heard from their minister or their rabbi, or and so they have an idea. And then when they have the experience, it's a bit frightening for them. So oftentimes people have departing visions and it scares them because it takes them totally by surprise. But as time goes on, as the visions continue, they begin to calm down. So what I shared with her is that that it was wonderful, first of all, that her father was so spiritual, that he had made peace with death and dying, and that they could talk about it as a family, but that B, he had a departing vision where relatives who he really, really loved and really, really cared about and who loved him and had nurtured him when they were alive came to visit him right before he passed. And what a wonderful experience that was. And I passed on to her a glimpse of heaven, hoping that that will explain some of her experiences. Glimpse of Heaven is one of the books that I wrote that talks about deathbed visions. So anyway, based on this new drama series, Medium, the University of Virginia is conducting a study that seeks to prove whether the living can really talk to the dead. You know, I always crack up when it's like, it's newsflash, hello, new information. So it takes an NBC News drama to get the drums, you know, get people beaten on their drums. Medium tells the real-life story of Allison Du Bois, an Arizona mother of three, who claims to see dead people and help solve police murder cases. Now, for those of you who don't know, there is a researcher who is very, very popular among my circle, and his name is Dr. Gary Schwartz. Dr. Gary Schwartz has been researching mediums for a long, long time, and I think he has researched Allison Du Bois. We know it can be done. There is a history of mediums who worked under these conditions in the 20s and 30s and did quite well. Does anybody know about the Chautauqua back east? Back east, there are parts of the eastern seaboard where there are groups of mediums that live in towns together, and that's what they do. They hang out their shingles. You go to some of these communities, and it's Mediumville. Actually, when I go to London, I'm going to go visit the Society for Psychic Exploration and get a reading done. I've always wanted to do that in London, and I've never done it. And this time I'm going to take a break from listening to firsthand accounts about the Holocaust and catch the tube, and I'm going to go get a reading done. Continuing, this is the first study that the University of Virginia, a reputable place, by the way, has conducted with mediums in 30 years. The Division of Personality Studies, now this is Bruce Grayson's stomping grounds. He is one of the original founders of the International Association for Near-Death Studies. Typically researches reincarnation, near-death experiences, deathbed visions, and out-of-body experiences. So it looks like Bruce and company are going to be looking at medium. So I'm going to drop Bruce an email and find out what's going on, and then I'll give you guys a report. So with all of this interest in the paranormal and life after death, you would think, aha, it's safe for me to come out of the closet with my own shares about the afterlife. But be cautious. Have some boundaries. I found this really disturbing story, and it kind of validated a lot of the emails that I get from individuals who say to me, where do I go? I've had this incredible experience. It was life-altering. It changed my perception of the world, the universe, my community, my family, my religion. It forced me to change my priorities. I'm not so materially oriented. I want to be of service to those around me. Where do I go to get some support? A lot of folks do go running to their churches, and they do go running to their ministers, and they do go running to their rabbis. I know very few ministers, rabbis, and priests who will openly be there for those of us who have had these experiences, as this BBC News report shares, and this is Church Condemns Paranormal Course. Church leaders have condemned a course in paranormal studies as potentially dangerous. This is at a college in the UK. The 5 2-hour evening lectures conducted by a medium Now, in the UK, there are also groups of folks all over the place who they're mediums, and they belong to certain types of organizations, religious communities, where they get together and they work on fine-tuning their medium abilities. So here we have somebody, Sharon Gound is the name of this woman, who was going to teach this wonderful series at this college, and the archdeacon of the church got very upset. He said he feared vulnerable students may not be able to cope with the experience. I'm still trying to figure out what that's all about. So they're not going to be able to cope with the experience of making contact with loved ones, or I'm not real sure what the problem is here. But Ms. Gown said, this is a fabulous opportunity to clear up ignorance and misunderstanding about the paranormal, and we need this desperately. The course involves the medium contacting her own spirit guides to whom students can pose questions. Doesn't seem like a horribly threatening situation to me. Sounds like we've got somebody here who is a pretty experienced medium who knows what she's doing, and it sounds like church people are getting upset. But this archdeacon said there are many bereaved people who are at a vulnerable stage in their life where they might not be able to handle something like this. Now, I do have to say that there are folks out there who do take advantage of the bereaved, and that is a problem. That's why we need to come out of the closet, those of us who have had these experiences, those of us that research these experiences, those of us that are very familiar with these experiences. Yes, there are those who are trying to make a quick buck off the bereaved. I get lots of them in my office who come in, they sit down, they're very upset because they've gone to see some, quote, psychic who really isn't a psychic. They just know how to do a cold reading. And they give them information that is that doesn't make sense to them. And then they shame them because they're unaccepting of the information. But that's a totally different story. This is a person who knows what she's doing. My message to the college would be to be aware that Christian churches offer ministry to those who are bereaved, not through contact with those they have lost, but pastorally. So what this guy is saying is that we don't want you taking our job away from us. So if you go see people who really can either teach the bereaved how to make contact themselves, which is what I do, along with grief counseling, because just because we make contact, that doesn't get rid of our grief. I'm going to do a whole show in January on grief and how to address grief and how to make contact. I'm going to give some specific information. But this guy is cracked. I mean, basically, he's afraid of losing his job. The college said its role was to open up educational opportunities, and this was not one of them. So here again, we have church folk basically saying that the paranormal has no place in the church. So are we too fragile, too vulnerable as a society to look at life after death? I mean, every time I read this sort of stuff, I just get hot under the collar because no, we are not. According to Dave San Filippo, a doctoral candidate, religion and beliefs in life after death have been going hand in hand forever. Lots of folks, I just reviewed a dissertation out of Australia where a woman going after her doctoral degree in psychology did a whole dissertation on near-death experiences, and she did a great job. And in her review of the literature, when a person does a dissertation, they have to review all of the literature that's available, and that's a, you know, hefty 15 to 30 page experience. But she did this great review, and this guy, he's getting ready to do his doctoral dissertation, and he did a wonderful review too. And so I'm going to just share some of the stuff that he has instead of reinventing the wheel, because what he did a great job. But anyway, polls and studies support the assumption that the majority of people believe that death is not the end of one's existence, but rather a transition from one life to another. Boy, I wish these churches would get in line with this stuff. Different religions have provided belief structures that support the religious and social needs of practitioners. Rituals and sacred writings support the various religious interpretations of what death is. But today, in the here and now, these are my words, they will not accept paranormal experiences. However, even with the differences in religious beliefs, there are similarities between many different religious groups regarding afterlife beliefs. You know, we got all this fighting going on all over the world. People are fighting over religion. And if you sit down and really look at all forms of religion, they're so incredibly similar. One similarity among religious groups is the belief in an afterlife following physical death. Okay, sir, if you look at all religion, I don't know of any religion that says physical death is the end and you just become worm food. That's it. Doesn't work that way. A belief in the immortality of the spirit has been present in most religions for centuries. Proving the immortality of the human soul has been the objective of many philosophers, theologians, and scientists. Now, what is so interesting is that in investigating many life-after-death beliefs, there is a detailed discussion of what happens when the physical body is no more. There is always some sort of discussion about transition to some sort of spiritual world in every religion, gang, and there is always discussion with encounters with other deceased people and religious figures. The interesting thing in collecting the departing visions of the dying is that, as I have shared with you, there is a consistency with regard to what people see. What they see is deceased loved ones. They don't see the living. They constantly report deceased loved ones. Now, periodically they will talk about seeing angels. The other thing they will discuss is they will discuss seeing religious figures that are specific to their religion. So Christians will see Jesus, Jews will see Moses, Muslims will see Muhammad, Buddhists will see Buddha. And my take on that is that, doesn't it make sense that if I'm getting ready to cross over, that if I do see a religious figure and I'm a Christian and I'm comfortable with the concept of Jesus, I'm not going to see Muhammad. But near-death experiences and the reports of a consciousness of life after death have been provided by members of the Buddhist religion, Hindus, Islam, the Jewish religion, Christians, the Mormon religion, and those are just a few. And believe it or not, this is going to crack you guys up, agnostics and atheists also have reported near-death experiences, even with their predisposed lack of belief in anything greater than personal self and this life. When One Last Hug came out, my book One Last Hug, The Mystery and Meaning of Deathbed Visions came out, I was invited to do the show Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher. And I didn't have a lot of interest in doing that show, but I had a publicist who pushed me. And so I flew out there and did the show, and I was supposed to be on the show with the amazing Randy, who is involved with the organization that likes to go around debunking anything that has to do with the paranormal, the Skeptical Inquirer. I'll have to look that up. I can't remember what they call themselves. But needless to say, the amazing Randy was in China And so, thankfully, I didn't have to appear on the show with him. But I did appear on the show with a surgeon, a very well-known surgeon who had written a book on the physiology of physical death. Yeah, he was a ton of fun. And he had no sense of spirituality, none. And he really truly believed that after we died, we just, there was nothing. That was it. Nada, finito, it was a done deal. And so I came on board. It was a Halloween show. So as usual, they wanted to talk about spook stuff. So they saw me as somebody who was a spook author. So they invited me to be on the show. And I was on the show with George Hamilton and another star, some female movie, sitcom, TV star. I can't remember who she was. But anyway, I talked a little bit about departing visions and answered everybody's questions. And this guy, the surgeon, was invited on the show to counter me. So he was out to shred me, basically, and make me look like an idiot. I mean, I've had that happen on various shows. I've done Geraldo Rivera and Sally Jesse Raphael and bunches of different types of shows on everything from incest to addiction to spirituality. And on this show, it was Deathbed Visions. And well, needless to say, this guy, he took some pokes at me, and it was time to move on to another topic, and Bill Maher was tired of listening to me. But George Hamilton was very interested in continuing this discussion. And so he basically, my topic lasted a little bit longer. And I don't think that the surgeon was real happy about that. And he took a few more pock shots at me, and then eventually we did move on to something like hormones and breast milk. I don't know. I can't remember. But after the fact, he and I communicated for a little while. And what I discovered about him was that, and this is what I typically discover about individuals who are atheists or agnostic, they have unresolved grief issues. They have a loss that has taken place early in life, and they have never made peace with that loss. And so for them, what happens is there is a lot of anger towards religious institutions. There is anger toward concepts of spirituality. And so what they do is they turn their back on the whole kit and caboodle, and they beat their heads against the wall trying to prove to the universe that basically there is no such thing as God, a higher power, a universal order, or life after death. What I discovered about this surgeon is that he had lost somebody very, very dear to him when he was 4 years of age. And he had never, ever made peace with that. And he was very, very, very angry at concepts of God and religion. So there you have it, gang. A lot of times what happens is that people, they see the hypocrisy in religion, or they have a grief situation come up with regard to religion. They see it as a bunch of hocus pocus, and so they throw the baby out with the bathwater, and that includes the paranormal. And they see people like me who enjoy investigating this and hearing these stories. They look at me and they think, you know, freak, she's a nutcase. But anyway, there are some folks who are coming around, and they're actually doing dissertations on this stuff. Getting back to this, near-death experiences for sure have been reported in every branch of religion. But what is so interesting is that the major religions of the world don't look at this. I truly believe that the major religions of the world, at the base of all religion, is either an after-death communication, a near-death experience, or a departing vision. Atheists who believe that there are no God, that there is no God, as I have said, have reported near-death experiences. Believe it or not, these experiences are similar to the reports of individuals who have professed a spiritual belief. Okay, they're religious. Religious people who have near-death experiences, the agnostics and atheists, their experiences are incredibly similar. Go figure. Most agnostics and atheists interpret their near-death experiences as they, you know, they get a glimpse of life after death. prior to the near-death experience, they have no belief in life after death, but as a result of the experience, these experiencers eventually move toward a more spiritually guided life with a newfound belief in life after death. Very interesting. Buddhists and Hindus. Now, Buddhists believe that upon death there is rebirth into another life. Hindus believe that the afterlife is just a passage of time and a heaven or hell, and that it's dependent upon the karma built up in life. There are reports of Chinese Buddhists having near-death experiences. Now, my friend Jeffrey Long, he collects a lot of near-death experiences, and as does another friend of mine named Kevin Williams. I mean, these guys collect lots and lots of these accounts, and they have accounts from the different religions. A Hindu report of a near-death experience relates that the experiencer entered into heaven on the back of a cow. Well, for Hindus, cows are a really big deal. It's like your reincarnated relative, so wouldn't that make sense? Now, Japanese experiencers report seeing symbolic images such as long, dark rivers and beautiful flowers. During the near-death experience, the Buddhist experiencers have reported seeing, of course, Buddha. They don't see Moses, they see Buddha. And guess who the Hindus see? They see Krishna. My buddy Ring reported this in 1980. The difference in the Buddhist and the Hindu reports of the near-death experiences is predominantly related to the afterlife setting and the people or religious figures encountered. So here we have a great example based on the research of Kenneth Ring, that you have these two religions who basically they're almost identical except for the religious figures that they might see. That says something, doesn't it? Researchers have shown that ancient Japanese Buddhists, that the deathbed visions that they have reported parallel modern American near-death and deathbed visions. Now, Islam, I mean, everybody is, you know, people talk about the Islam religion and what is their belief in life after death. Well, death basically, all it is for them is a cessation of biological life and a resting of the spirit until the judgment day. But, believe it or not, Muslims have reported having near-death experiences. And Muslims, think, American near-death experiences. You leave the body, you go through the tunnel, you see the light, you go visit grandma who's passed on, you have a chat with Uncle Sam, and then you come back through the tunnel. Well, guess what, gang? Muslims have the exact same experience. They meet recognizable spirits. And they basically talk about having conversations with spirits on the other side who are there to welcome incoming souls. The incoming souls of the newly deceased, Raymond Moody, dug this bit of information up in the 70s, along with Don Morse, who's another buddy of mine, and Kenneth Ring. So in the Muslim near-death experience, the being of light is identified as Allah. For Christians, it might be Jesus. For Jews, it might be Moses. But there's always this being of light that everybody talks about. Wouldn't it make sense if I have a near-death experience and I leave my body and I go through the tunnel and I go to the other side and I see this being of light, and that's all I see is a being of light. And that's what people port is, a being of light. Wouldn't it make sense that I would attribute my concept of a spiritual guru or a spiritual master to that being of light? So wouldn't it make sense that when a Muslim sees a being of light, they'd identify it as Allah? Some Muslims interpret the near-death experience as a possible glimpse into life after death. And believe it or not, Muhammad had experiences like this. An Islamic myth describes Muhammad's, one of his He had a spiritual experience that described passing through the realms of the afterlife, where he encountered spirits who have died and had a vision of heaven, and then he communes with Allah. Now, Judaism, a lot of people believe that the Jews don't have a belief in the afterlife. That is so not true, totally not true. I found my examples of my first deathbed visions, believe it or not, after I had had deathbed visions and went searching for something to validate my experiences, guess where I found them? I found them in my own religion. There are several different branches of Judaism. There's the Orthodox branch, there's the conservative branch, and there's the Reform branch. Orthodox Jews believe that immortality will bring the resurrection of the body and the soul, followed by the judgment of the worth of their lives by God. So if you're an Orthodox Jew and you die, what they're going to do is they're going to bury you within 24 hours. That's just part of Orthodox and conservative and Reform Judaism. But if you are an Orthodox Jew, and let's say you have to have a leg amputated, your leg will be buried in the grave that the rest of your body will be buried in upon your physical death, because there is this belief that you're going to be resurrected. But many Jews believe that the human souls will be held accountable before God for what has been accomplished in this life. After death, many Jews believe that they will be reunited with family members in heaven. Okay, we keep hearing this over and over again with all these religions. Everybody's going to have a big party with their family members after they pass, after they physically die. It doesn't matter if you're a Jew or a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Christian. Jews don't believe in hell. Nope, gang, we don't believe in hell. Never have, never will. There have been a number of reported near-death experiences by members of the Jewish faith. Barbara Harris, who's a delightful woman, she's a friend of mine, and she's a practicing Jew. She had a near-death experience. She wrote a great book called Full Circle, The Near-Death Experience and Beyond. And it's basically, it's a narrative of her near-death experiences. So if you're out there and you're Jewish and you don't think we Jews have these encounters, go get her book. Jewish people who have had a near-death experience relate similar observations and experiences as the experiences of other religious spiritual believers. Shocking, shocking, shocking. During the near-death experience, the individuals report being in the presence of, here we go again, it's the being of light, and they're judging their own lives. That's that past life review that's so often discussed with the near-death experience. This experience is similar to the Jewish belief that what is important in life is the attending to the responsibilities of living a meaningful, productive life. Christianity. Modern Christians are united in their belief that Jesus is the Son of God and that there is an afterlife, and that upon death, Christians believe that they will come before God and are judged. Heaven and hell are viewed as a condition such as happiness or peace, but some religious groups do believe that it is a place. Regardless of whether the afterlife beliefs are interpreted conservatively or liberally, the Christian believes that he or she dies only once and that after death the spirit is judged. Okay, so all of these religious groups that we have looked at so far have talked about we are judged for our behavior. We take a look at how we've behaved in this life. But Christians do believe that one exists in the afterlife for eternity. Now, near-death experiences appear to be familiar. They're a very familiar experience for Christians. 98% of clergy surveyed, well, we never know what type of clergy that is, so that might be not a really great statistic. That they have counseled parishioners who have had near-death experiences. As with other religious interpretations of the near-death experience, Christians also report encounters with religious beings such as Jesus, Mary, or angels. Experiencers report out-of-body experiences, meeting family. Here we are again. We're at that party. Movement toward that bright light. a sense of being in the presence of an energy or an unconditional love. Now, sadly, some Christians refute the near-death experience as being a demonic deception. They believe that the entire near-death experience is a trick of Satan to pull believers from the teachings of Christianity and to lead them into sin. How many years ago was this? What, 2 years ago? There was this wonderful near-death experience that was running around the internet. The individual who had the near-death experience talked specifically about leaving the body and going to the different realms of the afterlife and meeting up with deceased relatives and his guides, and gave a full account of what happens once we are in the afterlife and how we take ourselves with us. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful account. And so what I did, of course, is I cut and pasted it and I sent it out to everybody on my email list. Big mistake, no boundaries, Carla. Well, it ended up in the hands of several people who happened to be on my email list for other reasons. And they were fundamentalists. They were hardcore fundamentalists. And I got some violent responses from them. Basically, they said that this was witchcraft, that I was perpetuating black magic, that I was going to hell. How could I send something like this out? I'm a psychologist. This is so irresponsible. That I was accused of hurting people who are bereaved, and I was told that I was acting incredibly irresponsible. And one person even sent me an email and told me that they were going to turn me over to my psychology board, my state board, for behaving so with such irreprehensible, unabashed behavior. And it was a very, very strong reaction. And so since that time, I have become a little more cautious about what it is I share. But this is what cracks me up. I mean, fundamentalists, their whole religion is based on after-death communications and departing visions. In the Apostle Paul's letter to the Corinthians, Paul records a vision he had. The vision resembles the content of a near-death experience. It involved Paul, the Apostle Paul, being taken up to heaven for a visit with Jesus and hearing things so astounding that they were beyond man's power to describe or put in words. In modern day accounts, that's what I hear over and over again. These experiences were so overwhelming, it is impossible to describe them or put them into words. Near-death experiencers consistently report the difficulty of verbalizing what they experienced, the effect of this experience, and how it has changed their life. Well, gang, the effect of this experience on Paul basically started a whole new religion. The early Christians, they were a small minority. The early Christians were not the ones who got Christianity off the ground. It was the Apostle Paul, after he had his vision, his experience, his deathbed vision, his near-death experience, whatever it was he had. There is some information that suggests that the Apostle Paul had a little problem with alcohol and wasn't living a real kosher life before he had this experience. And it was this experience that rocked his world, changed his life, put him on the road to proselytizing for the Christian religion. He began preaching what Jesus had said, and he, along with Constantinople's mother, began the creation of a whole new religion. So go figure. We're going to run over a little bit today because I just want to get through a little bit more of this. Mormonism. Do you know that the Mormons are very, very open to near-death experiences. This actually is a part of their religion. Also, deathbed visions are not—that's not unusual for Mormons. I did lots of shows out of Salt Lake City discussing deathbed visions, and have had lots of encounters with Mormons with regard to deathbed visions and near-death experiences. Because death in the Mormon religion is not considered the end of existence of the individual, but the beginning of a new existence for that same person. It's kind of like changing addresses. Mormons believe that they have always lived and will always live as the same individual, never as someone else or in another life form. A belief in the afterlife is the essential part of their faith. So, experiencers who are Mormons report that they see a panoramic review of their entire life. There we have that life review thing going on again, judging our own lives, and then judge their own actions. But they are in the presence of that being of light. There's that being of light again. After the judgment, the spirit dwells with others that are most like it, as with many other religious groups. Mormon near-death experiencers constantly report meeting deceased family members and being in the presence of a being of light, which they call God. So members of the Mormon religion, they actually do report a high number of near-death experiences compared to other religions. And you know why? It's because it's so openly accepted. The religion actually encourages individuals to share these accounts. So basically, what we have here, we have a little brief rundown for this show on the religions that are very prominent in our culture today and how they view life after death. And what we have seen tonight is that this is nothing new for the major religions. So my question is, and I would love to hear from you, why is modern day religion so incredibly opposed to hearing about these things? Why are the rabbis, I'm going to get mad, and the priests and the ministers and the clerics out there having such a hard time hearing from those in their congregations, those that they are supposed to be serving, those that they are supposed to be comforting? Why can't they hear these accounts? According to my buddy Ring, many near-death experiencers, what they do is they attempt, after having these encounters, and I've come across this too in my research, after they have these encounters, these fantastic, mind-altering, life-changing, spiritual experiences, which erase any fear of death, which let the experiencer know that the priority in life is to be of service and to continue the spiritual journey. Why is it that once they try to incorporate this new sense of spirituality into their lives, their life with their religious organization becomes a challenge? And what ends up happening is, for many experiencers, is it becomes less important to be a member of a specific religious group than to practice a more spiritual life not based upon spiritual doctrine. I do have to say, if my rabbi, who is my best friend, one of my best friends, if he were not open to my experiences involving near-death experiences and encounters with spirit, I would not be participating in my religion. Basically, what Kenneth Ring says, is that some experiencers choose to remain or become active in an organized religion in order to practice their new spirituality. They really do work at incorporating. It is therefore important for there to be an openness by religious groups towards individuals who report these encounters, and to not condemn the phenomenon as religious heresy. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Next week, in 2 weeks, we're going to continue our discussion. I have some wonderful, wonderful, wonderful firsthand accounts that are directly tied into religion. that have to do with different types of experiences that have been around for eons. I'm going to give you a little taste right now. In my book, One Last Hug Before We Go, I included actually some paranormal experiences from Jewish Hasidic literature. Now, a Hasidic Jew, those are the Jews who you see a lot of them in L.A. and you see a lot of them in New York. They dress completely in black. They study Kabbalah not as Madonna studies Kabbalah. They study Kabbalah. They're very intent. For Hasidic Jews, one cannot study Kabbalah until they are married, until they are gainfully employed, and until they are 40 years old. They have to be grounded in the earth before they can experience the spirit. But anyway, in these some of these Jewish Hasidic tales, there are incredible tales of deathbed visions. 1 hour before a rabbi passed, a Hasidic rabbi passed, centuries ago, he was a famous rabbi, and he used to have his rabbis back then, they would have their following, so all their students would follow them around, and students would spend their entire lives studying with a particular rabbi. But anyway, 1 hour before this particular rabbi died, he saw his deceased father. And he saw his deceased father standing right next to him. He also saw his deceased teacher. Now, another famous rabbi, when he was buried, this actually was the founder of the Hasidic movement, his students saw his soul leave the earth plane. These followers of this historically famous rabbi describe seeing a blue flame ascending into the heavens. This account is centuries old. It's at least 3 centuries old. People who have deathbed visions oftentimes see something leaving the body. So the followers of this rabbi saw something leaving the burial ground and ascending to heaven. So what we're going to do in 2 weeks is we're going to take a closer look at religion. We're going to go back. We're going to dig around. We're going to look at some of the specific after-death communications, near-death experiences, and deathbed visions that are found in religion that our religious leaders are not sharing with us. And what that will show is that, as I have said, all of the major religions are basically a lot alike, and that these encounters have been around for eons. So thank you so much for joining me. As always, if you have something you would like to share, please feel free to email me at drsbrandon@sbcglobal.net. That's drsbrandon at sbcglobal.net. Or you can go to my website at www.carla, Wills, Brandon, com. Have a pleasant evening and sweet dreams.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.